Many thanks to Richard Crispin for suggesting today's two guests. Their names are Janet Lane and Roz Sexton. Janet and Roz are two women from different backgrounds who share a love for whalers. And by whaler, I don't mean people who harpoon the creatures of the sea. I'm talking about a kind of horse, whaler, spelt W-A-L-E-R. Whalers are uniquely Australian horses, created from a bunch of different breeds in wild Australian conditions. Now they're an endangered animal, but a century ago they were everywhere in Australia. They made perfect workhorses, and then when Australia went to war, they became outstanding war horses, arguably the finest cavalry horses in the world. And they were critical to the charge of the Australian Light Horse at Beersheba. The soldiers who rode them often felt an intense love for these sure-footed, unflappable creatures. And they were heartbroken when they had to leave their whalers behind in the Middle East. After the First World War, fewer and fewer whalers were needed to work the land, and so thousands of them went wild, running in mobs around the interior of Australia. And they were culled as pests. Both Roz and Janet helped form the Whaler Horse Owners and Breeders Association of Australia to save them from disappearing altogether. Hello, Roz. Hello, Janet. Welcome to you both.
Hello, Richard.
Thank you, Richard.
Roz, how many different horse breeds make up the Whaler? What's going into that mix?
It's a combination of breeds, Richard. You get three types of Whaler, a pony type, with the small horse that has its origins in the British native pony or even the Timor pony. And then you have the medium type horse, which is usually very old line thoroughbred. And then you have the cold blood, which is a Clydesdale, Suffolk Punch or Percheron. So generally you get a horse that has tremendous bone and quite often some feather as well.
What does feather mean?
It's the hair around their fetlock. And that's quite often bred out of horses these days, and people who like to show horses of different breeds usually shave off this feather, but it's very popular and always was in the horse, and also too it's very good for the horse's feet because it distributes oil to their feet and around the coronet.
You just look at when Australia was colonised, where the ship routes were, to see what horses were brought here. So a lot came from England, which were virtually every breed that was in England, and they brought the best because it was such a long voyage. Then they stopped at the Cape, so we had a lot of Cape horses came out, for example, on the First Fleet. But a little known fact is that another shipping route came from Chile, and we had a lot of horses come through Valparaiso, the port of Chile, about 40 years, solid years of horses coming from Chile. And the other major source were the Timor ponies, because that was close. People made their living just bringing Timor ponies, and a lot of the explorers used Timors. So they had a really fantastic mix, and it was in the days before the internal combustion motor had been invented, so everyone needed horses, and horses were used for everything. You know, coaches, they pulled trams, deliveries, and it was right when Mr. McAdam had invented the macadam surface, which had revolutionised horse-drawn vehicles. Someone had just invented the metal plough after thousands of years. So all of a sudden, the horses were at their breed. You had the best breeds in the world in history when Australia was settled, and we just threw them in a big melting pot.
So were they bred specifically for Australian conditions, or are they a bit
Absolutely.
Of an accident of horses all just
no,
mingling together?
No, they weren't. Because England had colonised India as well and just literally needed hundreds of thousands of horses, a lot of the early soldiers and government people who were sent here had been in India, and they immediately identified us as being a horse breeding place for India and just set about immediately breeding horses for India. And the people's biggest sports were racing, polo, and in India, pig sticking.
Pig hunting, is it?
Yeah, hunting large bulls over 5 feet long and 3 foot high and extremely savage.
Right, so they were bred here for specific conditions from within the British Empire.
Yes,
then.
Yes, absolutely.
So how trainable are they?
Oh, very tractable. We did have a few horses that were badly traumatised when they arrived, and we couldn't really do anything very much with them other than turn them out and look after them and feed them well. But the majority, certainly in all the horses that I know of, came to people that had never broken in horses before. And so it was a very steep learning curve. They needed a lot of time, a lot of patience, but we didn't have too many failures.
Why do they generate so much affection in people, Janet?
What it is, I think they're caught in a time warp. So they were developed in the era when people depended on horses. So, like Asimov's first law of robotics, thou shalt not harm a human being, horses had to be safe. They had to be strong, and they had to have, in a big country like Australia, unlimited endurance.
So, they were brought. They were bred under a similar idea of Isaac Asimov's law of robotics.
Yes,
thou shalt not harm a human being.
Your horse had to be safe, you know, in the city, in the country, around your children, everything, without thinking. It was like your car.
So they had to be an unflappable beast.
Unflappable,
to be in town and city conditions.
Wise
then.
And intelligent. So no inbreeding. And fortunately, we had such huge spaces, so we could breed them, and they developed that survival hardiness as well. But another special feature, because they wanted them for war horses, was the sort of one-man aspect, like a blue heeler dog, that they bond to you. So if a whaler bonds to you, it will do anything for you. And if it doesn't like you, well, sorry, no, give it to someone else.
This might be a really silly question, but are they affectionate? Do you even think of horses
they
as being affectionate?
My mare at home, she's getting old now, but she'll come up wherever I'm in the paddock and lean on me for a hug. Just look at, put her head over my shoulder. The extremely affectionate. I could call mine in 100-acre paddock out of sight. All I'd say once is, come on, and you hear the hoofbeats. They want to be with you. You know, they just love you. They're like in a time warp, you know, from how horses were in the days of horses. They weren't bred to be pretty or fancy at all. They were just a solid working horse.
Steady, hard-working. They bond to humans.
Bond. Mm. If you're in war, that horse saved your life. If you were out mustering the outback by yourself, your life depended on that horse.
Jenna, where did your love of horses come from?
I think I was just one of those children, probably like Roz, who was just born with an insane love of horses. And I remember when I was young, my dad worked for the CSIRO, and we were on Moriah Island off Tasmania. And there was a chap there, a hermit called the Wild Man.
The Wild Man?
Yep, Ray French.
The Wild Man of the
Moriah Island. He didn't like people. But he and I got on like a house on fire. I think I was only about 4 or 5 years old at the time. And so he did everything on horseback. And he said to me, out of his horses that he had, he said, see this horse. This horse is a whaler, and this might be the last whaler you'll ever see. And I just thought, it's a beautiful horse. And it's the only horse he would put me on, too, as a small child.
Why was the breed expected to disappear then?
There was no use left. You know, the car had been invented. People had trucks and cars. And for that time after World War II, people weren't quite as wealthy as they were now. The horses weren't used much for recreation. So by the 1960s, when people wanted horses for recreation, where are they? You either had race horses or you sent to America or somewhere for a horse. And just one day I was thinking, I wonder where the whalers are. Where are they? And I thought the only way is to start a little group up, see if anyone else thinks the same. So advertise. And all these people like Roz, Peter and Pat Fisher and wonderful people got in touch, said, yes, we're all wondering where they are too. And then I was listening to the ABC and heard a chap in the Northern Territory talking about the government shooting all the whalers on the old stations that bred them for India. And, of course, we just thought, oh, my God.
There are other whaler fanatics out there. So when you held a talk in Hobart about whalers, who showed up for that?
Well, I advertised for the newspaper, which, of course, had American spell check and put an H in it, because lots of darling old men interested in boats turned up. We had a lovely time.
But so whalers with an H showed up?
Yes. It was great fun. Some horse people got it.
Right. I'll catch your whale for you, lady. That kind of thing.
We'll go harpooning off the horses.
I am with two women who have a love for whalers. Their names are Roz Sexton and Janet Lane. They're both members of the Whaler Horse Owners and Breeders Association of Australia. Now, how about you, Roz? When was your first introduction to this beautiful horse?
My husband was posted to Darwin with the RAF as a fighter pilot, and we were to be going there for about 3 years. And I'd never owned a horse before. I'd always been riding everyone else's horses over the years, and then had a very big gap where I didn't ride at all. So when we arrived in Darwin, I bought myself a retired thoroughbred and leased two ponies for our daughters. One day, this truckload of horses came up. It was a very large truck with a lot of horses on it. And I was intrigued by these horses. They looked a little bit different to anything I'd seen before, and I had seen a lot of horses over the years. When I inquired around, they said, oh, these are the whalers, and they've come from Mount Riddick Station in the Harts Ranges north of Darwin. And my husband had always said to me, if I was a good camp follower for 20 years, I could have a farm or develop a horse stud. So straight away, my brain's ticking over and I was thinking, oh my goodness, I think perhaps I could have a whaler stud. So I inquired around and people said to me, oh, you need to talk to Mr. Reg Wilson. So I tracked Reg down. Now, Reg has a passionate interest in the Whyalla, always has, and his father and his uncle were light horsemen. So I went to see Reg, had a talk to him.
So this is the same Reg you were talking about, Janet, who you got in contact with after you heard him on Australia All Over. Yes.
But I got to meet him before anyone else because I was actually living in the Territory. So I became lifelong friends with Reg. He'd been a huge help to me. And also I asked him if he would identify and purchase for me a colt and a filly for my proposed Whyalla stud down the track, never thinking for one moment.
This would where it would all lead. So he was up in the Territory trying to get Whyallas to run on stations in the Territory. How did that work out? Was it appropriate to have Whyallas in that kind of territory?
Particularly well, because these horses came from drought country and they were used to drinking from dams and watercourses. And the horses in the top end, of course, couldn't go into the rivers because of the crocodiles. So a lot of the horses were going around sporting the most horrendous injuries from crocodile attacks.
Oh, they were being attacked by crocs as they went for a drink of water in the river.
A lot were taken, and others ended up with quite severe injuries.
So this was the man who got you in touch with one another.
Yes.
And that's how you two met.
Yes, and then he put us in touch with Peter and Pat Fisher in Victoria. And it was Peter and Pat that took the majority of the horses that came through the meatworks in South Australia that had been identified as coming from the correct stations. So they ended up with 18, 20 horses at a time, some of them very young, with dreadful injuries, unhandled. And fortunately, they were in touch with a vet, Tim, who was able to look after the horses for them. A lot of them had pneumonia. A lot of them had terrible injuries, puncture wounds and things like that.
Oh, and they were wild.
Very wild, yes, and traumatised. So you couldn't startle them or upset them. Whalers are such fabulous jumpers that they can just about get out of a tennis court with a roof on. That if you startle them when they're first trapped, then they just jump out of whatever's there. There's nothing will keep them in.
So we'd gone from a situation then where whalers were everywhere in Australia in the 19th century to this state that they're in today. Let's just follow the history then of how it came to pass. They were sent to Australia's early colonial wars. What were some of the places that the whalers were sent to?
Oh, it was extraordinary. India, hundreds of thousands of them, hundreds of thousands. A lot of the pasture releases for the Northern Territory and South Australia were just for horse breeding. A lot of New South Wales areas made their living from it. That's how they got their name, New South Wales, a horse from New South Wales shipped to India.
Right.
But the British had colonised lots of areas, so a lot went to China, a lot more than people realised.
What was going on in China?
The British were there in Hong Kong and in the Shanghai area, central China. They wanted them for paper chasing, which is a sport, for polo, just for riding, because that was your transport. And then about the turn of the 20th century up to the First World War, the Chinese themselves ordered them for their own army to fight the English. And then the Boer War, we sent about 38,000 to the Boer War. Then World War One came, we suddenly had 140,000 horses for the light horse, not by miracle, but because we were breeding that amount of horses to send overseas.
So how did their breeding prepare them so well as war horses?
A lot of it was just living on the range. You know, they were living in Central Australia in really tough country, so they had fantastic feet, fantastic legs, a lot of wisdom and intelligence. You know, if a horse was mad, it was just shot out of hand. That was a bit drastic, but you're cold for temperament. And, of course, a horse in the wild, having all these strong attributes, has a strong physique. He also holds his head up high so he can see a better distance. That suits the person who mostly rides with one hand because you've got a lance or a gun or a sword or something in your other hand.
How are they like under battle conditions, you know, where there's guns and artillery and all that kind of...
Just unlimited stories of people riding them into fire. I mean, Bill the Bastard is a legend.
Bill the Bastard?
Yes. A lot of whalers were sent away, of course, unbroken. So if a wrong person got them, they became buckers. Got a bad reputation, which is natural. Bill the Bastard bucked, and that's why he got his name. But at Romani, the Australians had come under fire, and some of them were stuck out in no man's land, pinned down by fire, and, you know, were going to die. And this chap got on Bill the Bastard and galloped out with full fire coming at him. Took one man in front of him, one behind the saddle, one each side, hanging on. Bill the Bastard galloped through the sand, under fire, out of there, with five men. It was the only time he didn't buck. countless stories about their loyalty. Another one that was a known bucker in India called Coronation. At the time George V was having his coronation, they had a Durbar, which is the biggest festival in the world, and the Viceroy, Lord Curzon, wanted to ride a whaler because that was the beast's knees. And he saw this magnificent chestnut whaler and everyone said, "No, you can't have him." And he wanted to know his name. They wouldn't tell him because it was a derogatory term. You know, he's a bucker. And Lord Curzon said, "No, I like that horse." And he got on it and the horse was perfect. Went out in front of the elephants and the charging regiments because it's like Lord Curzon.
And how do they perform at that charge at Beersheba, the Australian Light Horse Charge?
Oh, heroically, of course. That's the best known. But all through that wall in the middle, they often went 72 hours without water. And at that stage, they needed the water in the wells. Those horses had gone without water and without food and were tired and had campaigned for a long time. And the average weight on a whaler was about 21 stone with a man in his gear. And they charged at entrenched Turks with guns, you know, at flat gallop across the plain. Horses kept going with bullets in them. And, of course, they captured the walls of Beersheba, but the Turks surrendered when they got there. They rode into legend in that charge, in essence. Mm.
So after the war was finished, the First World War was finished, how many were brought back to Australia?
None. Only one as a token.
Why? Why were they all left behind?
It was heartbreak. Imagine if you'd gone 4 or 5 years with your horse who'd saved your life countless times, the heartbreak of not being... basically, the army didn't want to spend the money. They said it was quarantined, so no one really knows. They were ostensibly to be sold to the local populations. A lot of these countries were extremely poor, and the soldiers knew a poor person can't afford to look after a big horse. So they pretended they put their foot in a wombat hole and broke their leg and they had to shoot them.
What effect did that have on the men, typically, having to do that to kill these horses?
You can imagine you survive war and you saw your mates killed and you had to shoot your own horse. You can't imagine... I don't think you could imagine that. And you wouldn't let anyone else do it because that was cowardly.
Roz, tell me how you got to meet one of those men, one of the light horsemen, a man called Horace Flickroft.
Mr. Flickroft, he used to be interviewed occasionally on Anzac Day, and my family, I was looking after my elderly mother in Perth at the time. So I wrote to Mr. Flickroft and I asked him if I could come and have a chat to him about his experiences and about his horse. And he was the most wonderful, charming man, and he lived in Coolbinia in Mount Lawley. And I was having a few doubts about just exactly what path I was following with my breeding at that stage. I was turning out foals and not really sure whether I was putting the right horses together. So I took photos with me to show them to Mr. Flickroft. I'd turn up and there he would be in his suit with a tea service out, with a pot of tea there, and he'd have a chat. I showed him a photo of a filly that I bred, and he looked at this photo and burst into tears. And he said, "Oh, she is so like my Rosie." He had a mare, Roseanne, that he took with him to the Middle East, and he couldn't bring her home, of course, and I asked him what happened to her. Did he leave her behind? And he said, "No, I couldn't." He said, "I shot her." He was crying, and I was crying with him. It was absolutely terrible. And he was such a proud man, so it must have been quite terrible for him to be so emotional. He was very elderly then. He was in his 90s. I had several lovely visits with him and I learnt such a lot from him, and he talked about the temperament of the whaler, how when they come back absolutely exhausted from battle, the horses would lie down with them, and he said they'd have missiles going, you know, guns off going over their heads, and he said the horse would hardly raise its head, it was so exhausted. And the main attribute besides temperament he talked about was the horse's ability to walk. He said modern horses can't walk. And he said they
have... What do you mean? I don't know. What do you mean?
Really very fast, very long, fast walk. And also the ability to go very quietly from a walk into a canter so they can't be heard with everything that would rattle normally if they were trotting.
And it's extremely comfortable. You know, you don't feel... It's easy on the horse's body. It's extremely comfortable to ride. If you get around at a trot, it's really hard on you, and eventually it's hard on your kidneys, and it's very hard on the horse, and the horse will eventually break down. But a horse has got a long, fast walk. Like people used to say, well, it walks into battle, you know, because he could walk 200 miles to the fight. quickly.
So they don't so much trot they or canter, they fast walk.
They didn't trot. So they were known for their comfortable long walk. There's nothing worse than a horse that walks slowly. You know, nothing worse. You can walk faster yourself. You know, why would you bother? And another one that just reminded me too of Peter's Biljim. That was a wild stallion that came out of the bush. And when Peter and Pat were saving all the whaler bums down their property and then dispersing them, I went over to see them, you know, just to see what these whalers were like. And when I drove up, my heart just turned over, you know, and I just got tears and I thought, God, these are the real deal, you know. And there's this giant wild grey stallion that Peter had saved and bonded with. And Peter, you know, and I introduced each other, and he said, what do you think of Biljim? And I said, he's magnificent. And Peter just jumped up on his back in the paddock and stood there talking to me, standing on the horse's back, facing backwards, facing me, talking to me. And I said, isn't he a wild stallion? And Peter said, yeah, I've got to get around to breaking him in one day. So that just shows the, you know, their nature, you know, they like you, you're right.
Ros, tell me about, there's a place called the Brook Hospital in Egypt. Tell me about this place.
It's in Cairo, Richard, and it was established after the war with the horses being left behind. Of course, the people were very poor. They didn't know how to look after the horses, couldn't afford veterinary attention. And General Brooke's wife, Dorothy Brooke, established a hospital specifically for the horses and donkeys that were left behind there. And that hospital still operates today, and I believe vets from the London School of Veterinary Medicine go over there and do a certain amount of time there with the horses. And the people were taught how to feed them, how to look after them. I suppose it was some compensation for the horses.
So do you think then the story was that those light horsemen who performed so very bravely in the First World War, having to leave behind or kill their own horses, came back to Australia, many of them quietly grieving over these horses?
Oh, terribly. It would have been dreadful for them. It would be like leaving a family member there.
It's like any war. You know, you've probably known your own grandparent, father or someone who's come back and they just won't talk about war at all. And there was no recognition of trauma in those days. You lost your best mate and you lost your horse and you just had to live with it. The bizarre thing is you could be at an Anzac Day parade and the old horseman would walk up to our whalers and burst into tears.
Janet, your friend Jackie decided to ride a whaler on Anzac Day in Hobart. Yes. Just tell me what happened that day.
He was a black stallion who was, I think, chosen for his looks because he was 14 years old, but he normally chose young horses. And you would think no one was going to break in a 14-year-old wild stallion, but Jackie did very quickly. They bonded really well. And he'd only been out of the bush a few months and she thought she'd take him in Anzac Day parade in Hobart, which is huge. And we thought, oh, my God, you know. And the light horseman heard about it. He was in his 90s, Ray Chatterton in Melbourne, and said, can I come over and have a look? And Jackie said, of course. And on the day of Anzac Parade, we had two whalers, Brian Boru and Denny, Dardanil, the horse's name was. A light horse reenactment group turned up that we didn't know about in uniform on thoroughbreds.
Not whalers. So the light horse reenactment group weren't riding whalers?
No, they weren't. No. And I think because people couldn't get them and some people just wanted a horse. We weren't on the horse. We just reversed Jackie reversed the boots and the stirrups for respect. Anyway, the thoroughbreds, it was their first Anzac Parade and they played up. You know, they danced around being silly and they're asked not to go in it. And luckily, because the whalers just stood there, this is two wild horses from the bush, didn't move a muscle, and were put behind a pipe band. And anyway, we didn't know this old light horseman had turned up. We'd been standing there looking and he just walked over to Dardanil and put his hand on his nose and said, I've ridden many a mile on you, old man, and tears just poured down his face. And he walked the entire Anzac Day parade, now I'm in his 90s, with that horse to the cenotaph. And that just told us everything. These are the right horses. They were the horses off the stations that bred them for India, that bred them to go to war for us, and they are the right horses. They're the only people that can recognise them in that way. For years on Anzac Day, the light horseman always used to leave, not flowers, a big sheaf of oats or hay. And after a while, they got too old to go, no one did it. And no one was saying thank you to the horses. So to see the actual horses and to see someone's taken a sheaf of oats to them meant everything. That, you know, after 50 years or 80 years, someone's remembered. Yeah, it was just a nice, good feeling.
So what happened to the breed of the horse, the Whalers, in Australia after the First World War, Janet?
Well, all the horses that bred those horses were still here. But the market was slowly dying out because, of course, people were starting to use trucks and jeeps and motorised vehicles. What happened in World War II was quite interesting. The Australian Army supplied the Army with horses again, Whalers. And all the men trained in Australia with Whalers. Then when they were sent overseas, they were sent without them. And I interviewed light horsemen from then who were heartbroken. They'd spent months training their horses. But Australian Army finally woke up. We don't need them. The crucial stage is after World War II, when it really was petering out. People post-war were battling to make a living. The stations just turned them out that had them.
Yeah, what do you mean by turn them out?
Just let them go bush, because they were such big stations. Some stations may have tried to shoot some of them out to make room for cattle.
So they were just released into the wild?
Just released into the wild, because these were big stations of, you know, a couple of million acres. There was plenty of room.
So, Janet, after the Second World War, many of these great big properties turned them loose, you were saying, into the wild, in these kind of pretty inhospitable places by the sound
of things.
Absolutely.
That's why they're so hardy and why they got such an incredible reputation. You know, they outperformed every other breed of horse because they were just so hardy. You know, if a horse roams around 500, you know, miles in a couple of weeks just to survive, he's going to be a pretty tough customer.
So what was the state of the breed of Whalers, Ros, by the 1980s?
Well, we didn't know anything about it, as Janet mentioned, until we heard on the ABC and got in touch with each other. And then once we were in touch with Reg Wilson, we'd found he'd done all this authentication of horses on the stations that were left. And that's when we started saving some of the horses, but they had a brucellosis eradication campaign going. And
what was that?
It was to...
to shoot for horses, essentially.
I don't know that horses even carry brucellosis.
If horses got TB and brucellosis, they would give it to domestic horses and to cattle, and that would be terrible things. They would better shoot them. Mm. It was actually just an excuse to get rid of feral horses.
Mm. So there was culling going on, essentially.
Yes. Oh, huge culling.
Huge amount. Yes. And aerial shooting, which is banned in most countries, which is horrifically cruel.
You mean packs of horses being just shot from helicopters, you mean?
Oh, you just have to rot. You can't accurately shoot a moving target from a moving platform, so it's a very cruel process. It still happens. But what happened with some of the stations, because people had thought, oh, we still want a muster, let's go and buy some pretty quarter horses, some pretty Appaloosas or whatever, some racehorses. And they'd gone in with the Den Wild Whalers, which were running as Brumbies, and, shall we say, polluted the genes. So we couldn't get them. We had to get them from a station that still had the stock that were pure from the World War II days, which limited our stations. And by bad luck, they happened to be the stations that were being shot. So it was a race against time to get enough off to try and keep the breed going.
And these were the stations that Reg had validated over the years. Yes. So we knew that they were what we wanted, the real thing.
So you knew where to find the pure breed?
We've done loads of research. You know, we've seen their records. They used to write down every single horse that came off that went to Kidman's Horse Size at Kapuna, every horse that went to India. They wrote them down, you know, for generations. And then all of a sudden they just let them run wild. So
what were being done with the horses that were being culled?
If they're aerial shot, they're left on the ground to rot. If they're trapped in the yards, they're then taken to Alice Springs Yards and then taken. There's only two horse abattoirs in Australia, Metro in Queensland and Peterborough in South Australia. So they go on a very long journey to the meatworks. The sad thing is the welfare laws that apply to normal horses don't apply to feral, so they can be overcrowded in the trucks, not fed and not watered. And because they only go for dog food, it's a very low value. So there's no return if they did feed them or water them. So the time they got to the meatworks, in terrible condition, traumatised, may have gone 10 days without water, no food, overcrowded. You know, we got them with their necks jammed in the back of the truck for a week and trampled on the floor. And
One filly even arrived with a broken neck.
It's not
but
really
with a lot of nursing, she survived.
It was just a sort of a rough and ready way of getting rid of wild horses that was a bit...
In terms of the culling, do you sympathise with the graziers somewhat insofar as...
Of course, we're trying not to criticise anyone. We can understand excess feral horses being removed in some areas, being totally removed. That's fair enough. We just wanted access to some of these particular wild horses to get some off, and people were too frightened that we would make a fuss.
So there you are in different parts of Australia, and you're a small but dedicated group who are trying to preserve the breed of whale or horse.
A lot of people were I mean, I got letters from Prince Philip.
What did he say?
Fantastic job. He sent us an official one, then sent me lots of private ones making jokes and being really, really nice, really supportive, because he knew they were a rare breed, critically endangered. And he'd come out to the three-day event at Gawler and just said to everyone, where are all the Australian horses? All you people are riding European horses.
Did his interest come through polo? Was that what it was?
No, just because it was a rare breed, it was the Australian horse. He knew, of course, the Whaler. Everyone thought it was extinct and these people are saving it. Fantastic.
So there, you put your hand up to preserve these horses. The next thing you know, you're getting letters from royalty.
And the Queen sent a letter to another member of Elf. So, yes, it's surprising the people who are on board.
But outside the royal family, it seems that people were pretty indifferent, though, weren't they?
Oh, yes, but Michael Hodgman, who they used to call the mouth from the south in Tasmania, he was marvellous. He became our patron. We burnt his photocopier out, you know, doing our newsletters.
He's the father of the current Premier, I believe, isn't he?
He is, that's indeed. Right, yes. But a wonderful man, whether you voted for Michael or not, a wonderful man. And so he really helped, the Whaler, marvellous. You know, people like that, you just don't expect who's going to suddenly put their hand up and say, fantastic.
So once you'd identified where you could find these purebred Whalers, yes, from stations around Australia, what then, what could you do once you'd located them?
Extremely difficult. We tried approaching the landowners. They didn't want to know about it. I think they were terrified we were going to say, oh, you wicked cruel people, look what you're doing. Some managers would deal with us on the quiet. The truck drivers were the best. They would tell us when they came into the yard. So we would give them the equivalent of what they got at the meatworks and no more. And they didn't ask for more. Sometimes they didn't want it. They just were so pleased that, you know, we were saving these rare horses.
How did you get them out of Alice Springs and places like that?
With great difficulty. With the first lot of horses that came up to Darwin that Reg Wilson organised, he was very friendly with the Mount Riddit station manager, and so it was quite easy ordering horses there, and that's where Reg got my colt and filly that he subsequently sent down to me. But the rest of the time it was all just hit and miss, and we were just very lucky that we got the horses that we did. The biggest problem ended up being people were wanting to take them, willing to take them, and quite a few very keen people. But in the cold light of day, what do you do when the horse arrives? It's very badly injured and you don't have the right accommodation for it, in that several people were like me. They had a 40-acre block with no yards, no internal fencing, and a horse that's totally traumatised that needs treatment and needs breaking in.
Right, so it's still feral.
Very feral, yes. So, and this is testament to how good the horses are, because a number of us, you know, the saying ignorance is bliss, we took them on having never broken in a horse in our lives before and were actually able to handle them and get them up and going. And it was just as Janet says, the horses bonded with you. Mm. And so after you'd calmed them down and treated their injuries and everything, most of our horses, we didn't really break them in. We just put a saddle on them and on you got, and that was it.
We took a truckload over to Tasmania. They'd come down to Peter's by a commercial truck from Alice Springs and had it spill there, but they were still thin. And no transport in Tasmania would go and pick up a truckload of Brumbies, wild horses. And also the Abel Tasman then said, we won't have wild horses, we only have tame horses tied up on the ship. So we had to book the Australian trader. Anyway, there's an old man, Matthews, who'd had a cattle truck, and he'd never been out of Tasmania in his life. And I asked him, and he said, what are they? And I said, they're Brumbies, but they're Whalers. He said, oh, well, I'll go and pick them up. They'll be all right if they're Whalers. So he drove to Melbourne, put this truckload of wild horses on. It never had a rope on them. We drove to the Australian trader, it broke down at the wharf. The wharfies hid the horses overnight in the shed, and we gave them food and water. The next day we drove to the Abel Tasman and said, these are tame racehorses. Just standing there perfectly docile. It was an open truck as well, and Whalers can jump. And so we put them in the hold of the Abel Tasman. And you're not allowed to check on the horses at night, except when they make a call. So we were sitting in the bar, like, you know, chewing our nails off. And all of a sudden this emergency call came, all the horse people get to hold on, because if a horse gets out and goes mad, they just shoot it, because it'll wreck the ship. And we just rush down thinking, oh, my God. And they make the horse trucks all part together. It was a thoroughbred on a truck next to us going off his gone and got his head out through the little hole in the side of his truck and got his head caught.
So it wasn't one of your horses then?
No, $25,000 stallion, they had to shoot it. And ours were just standing there completely quietly looking at them. And they actually said, these are old, aren't they? We said, yes, most of them weren't even two. And we drove off in Tasmania, you know, so proud of ourselves.
So, Ros, you said you settled down in a property in Canberra and you asked Rich to give you a colt
and a filly. Yes.
What state were they in when they arrived on your property in Canberra? Oh,
in very poor condition, Richard, because they come off terrible drought country. And they'd been a drought for a long, long while. And they'd travelled a long way, of course, from the Alice Springs trucking yards. And the colt, it had a very bad accident before he left the station and had a piece of 2-inch water pipe run into the top part of his neck and also had a dislocated jaw. How he ever survived the trip south, I don't know. And even worse was that they arrived from very hot conditions to snow and freezing conditions onto a friend's property in Bungendore, south of Canberra. The mare was fine. She was very, very light on. In fact, she was looking quite emaciated. But the colt couldn't be caught because we couldn't put a halter on him or anything because of the head injury. And he couldn't eat.
What did you think you were in for? I mean, this poor injured horse, did you think you'd have to put him down?
Well, we actually tried. I called in a vet that I knew in Bungendore, and she came and hung around for a good couple of hours while we tried to catch him and couldn't catch him. So she said, well, look, I can't wait any longer. Call me when you catch him. Well, it was several days again before finally I managed to corner him, put a rope around his neck, get a friend to go and call the vet, only to find she'd gone to Queensland for 2 weeks. And it was just after this that we were sitting with the horses, trying to keep them nice and calm and reading them stories. And
You read stories to horses?
Oh, of course.
Does that work?
It does, yes, with whalers. Yes, it makes them very calm and they concentrate. They like your voice. So we're sitting on camp chairs, my daughter talking to her grey mare, Beersheba. And Brig was just hanging around this very old cattle ramp. That was all that was in this 40-acre paddock. And he was quite curious, put his head down, and I thought, he's going to have a very bad accident the way he's going, and he's going to get his head caught. And he did. And there was a terrible crack. And when I turned round, his jaw was where it should be. His eye was still very floppy and about an inch lower than the other eye. But from then on, he was able to be fed. So I just poured the feed into him and I spent at least an hour every day massaging his face. And I think that's one of the reasons why he ended up being a best friend and a beautifully tempered stallion.
So this horse of yours, Brigadier, had a badly damaged head.
Yes.
And he whacked his head and somehow knocked his jaw back into place.
Yes, dislocated jaw,
Do you think he might have known what he was doing?
I don't think so, no.
It was just an accident.
But from then on, I had a horse that still looked absolutely terrible that you wouldn't have given tuppence for, but I started pouring the feed into him and he could actually put his teeth together to graze. That had been his problem. He couldn't graze at all.
So, Ros, how about the filly, though, the filly you brought from the desert into the snow conditions? How did she adjust?
When the truck arrived with them, it was snowing, and the mare took only 4 days to grow a coat that was about 8 centimetres long. She looked like a grey yak. And it goes to show just how adaptable they are in different conditions.
So with Brigadier, how quickly did he recover now you were able to feed him?
Oh, it only took about 9 months, I suppose. And by then, we had our own property. And so I was able to really put a lot of TLC into him. And then I just let him grow and get over the injury. And the injury was so horrendous. I could fit my fist into the hole in his neck when he arrived. And as a mature horse, you had to look very hard to see where the scar was. It was a tiny little star about the size of my little fingernail. And so it's testament to their ability to overcome the most horrendous injuries.
So how did you go about developing your stud, Ros? Once you had these two?
By the time the horses recovered, I was very impressed with them. And so I convinced my long-suffering husband that we should send for some more horses. So I ended up buying some mares as the nucleus of the stud. and those were the mares that I used with my stallion to breed on.
Brigadier?
Yes.
So even though Brigadier didn't look too crash hot, he was still useful as a stud horse?
Oh, he ended up being a very, very handsome boy.
He completely recovered. Mm. You wouldn't know, if you looked at him, you wouldn't ever know he'd had any accident at all. He was
no,
a really
handsome
stallion.
And he went on to be a very big boy. Very
horse.
Yes.
And without being necessarily too vulgar, do they require much help in that process? Do you have to sort of push them together, or do you just need to put them in the same paddock and leave them alone?
Because he went into endurance racing, I never let him run with any mares because the mares call the shots. They're in charge, not the stallion,
really?
As you believe. Oh, no. The only time I ever put him with a mare overnight, it was my daughter's horse, and I thought, oh, they'll turn out a beautiful foal. And when I went out to them in the morning, he'd had his eyebrow split, and he had a split on his nose and a huge hematoma on his chest, and he wouldn't go near another mare for a long while. It was the best thing that ever happened to
him. You got
the
knockback.
Oh, very definitely. She really
so
took
don't,
to him.
They just don't like each other, even though you think they should, they just don't. And it can be nature's way of saying they're not compatible, because horses have several different blood groups. And so sometimes if you force mate them, the foal will die anyway when it leaves the mother's womb. So we sort of let them just do as nature intends and muddle along there.
Yeah. I always, what they call, hand-served with the mares.
What's that?
It's where you hang on to the stallion and you have the mare, someone hold on to the mare, and then you hold on to the stallion. And prior to that, I'd let them have a couple of G&Ts over the fence and a little chat. And then I'd bring
the stallion in.
And you hold on to the stallion so that if the mare isn't receptive, she's not going to kick his head off and not going to kick your head off either. And so then he mounts the mare, does the job, and that's it.
I remember
it.
Going to visit Rose, and she built a beautiful stable complex for Brigadier and beautiful yards. And she said, now, Janet, I'm glad you're here. We're going to hand serve as Brigadier for the first time. So without me realising, because the stallion was rather excited, so was the mare, and suddenly the stallion started rearing. Everyone was on the other side of the fence. And Ross said, I forgot to tell you, Janet, when this gentleman goes mad, it's every man for himself. And so we all went horizontal through the railings. But then Ross got back in and learned how to do it.
So, yes, so it was all a matter of me learning to do it.
But I do have to ask this, sorry. In your girlish dreams, did you ever imagine that one day you'd be clutching onto the back of a stallion while it was mounting a mare?
No, never. No,
I was frightened of stallions. And after Briggs started developing and growing and getting a little bit more bold, I kept thinking, oh, no, what have I done? I think I'm going to get hurt here. And Reg said to me, always remember to treat him as you would another horse. Don't let him know he's a stallion.
Right.
And it was true. And he always said, speak very quietly to him. Never shout at him or scream at him or anything like that. And Whalers rather like you speaking in a very quiet, calm voice, especially when they're panicked, and it seems to calm them down. But there were two mares, I think, over the years that came to stud, and he wouldn't have a bar of them. He just wasn't going to serve them. There was no way. And they were very receptive and quite happy with him, but no way. But when he'd be out and about being ridden down the road, he used to stop and want to talk to the old toothless scrubbers, not the fancy-looking thoroughbreds and Arabs. He really liked the old girls.
Yeah. But I did the opposite of Ross. I always had him in big bush runs, put the mares in, and didn't ever once see him mate. It didn't matter how receptive the mare was, he didn't want people to see. He would wait until it was night or take them bush, and then miraculously there'd be a foal eventually.
Well, I don't blame them, because did Brigadier ever resent you being present, Ross, I have to say, because isn't it a bit like, you know, you're trying to get on with your girlfriend and your mum's in the room? Is that what it's a bit like?
I don't recall it. No, maybe he didn't. I just ignored
I don't think Brig was.
I think the thing with Brig was that he was out and about. He was a working stallion. I travelled up and down the East Coast with him. He was so well socialised that I think the stud part of it was just an incidental to his life, because he loved being out and about with lots of other horses at these big endurance events.
And how long was he part of your life, Brigadier?
25 years. And I lost him three and a half years ago, and I'm still getting over it. So I know how those light horsemen feel.
You never do you?
You never get over losing a horse like that. And he was very much a one-person horse.
How are Whalers getting on these days? Are you succeeding in preserving
them? They're still critically endangered. We've got probably, optimistically, about 200, but we really need more unrelated ones to keep them going. So we've got some, but some more would be nice. If we could find any more. We've got one standing station in Western Australia that's still got some that they kindly let us have, which is wonderful. And so some of these other stations still got any left. We'd dearly love some more. It's all a matter. We're all getting old. You know, we need some younger people to sort of run with the research, making sure they're getting the right ones. But I think we will save the breed. I think the breed's being saved. And the people that've got them just love them so much. That's the best thing about them.
We're in a time where it's the centenary of the First World War.
It is,
and
yes.
Do you think that might lead to a revival of interest in these beautiful horses?
I think it would. A lot of people are doing light horse reenactment now, and a lot of people, they just turn up on any horse. It would be nice if they had the right horse. And people that do want a horse, a sensible horse, just to work. I mean, these horses can jump, but they've got fantastic cattle sense. They're really what you call easy keepers because they've got a large gut area from processing low-quality food in the wild that you don't need to spend a lot on feed. And, in fact, they don't like rich food. They get hot. In many ways, they're a great horse.
Ros, we were speaking earlier about Horace Flickroft, the veteran of the light horse, whom you went to visit before he died. And you got a photo of him with his horse from the First World War, which we'll put up on our Facebook page.
That would be lovely.
There's another picture you've got of your daughter.
Yes.
With her
mare Bathsheba.
Yeah. In the photo, they're sort of leaning into each other.
Yes. And I never had to have special stallion accommodation for my stallion. He just ran in a big paddock. And I would go out and I would lie on the grass and he would come over to me and he'd lie down with me. And I used to think, oh, that was just so wonderful. So it's like an 8-year-old with Elizabeth
like big
Taylor
pussycats,
with national birds in the movie.
Yeah, I had to just small running with some mares in a big run up in the Lake Country in Tasmania. I think there's probably, the paddock itself was probably about 5,000 acres. And you couldn't see the horses. It was just bush. And you just call out small once and just wait. And after a while, you hear the hoofs. And they'd all just run up, you know, and stop dead right where you were and then just lean on you. Mm. You know,
My stallion got out one day and he was going up the road to visit the Crabbed Arab stud up the road. And I thought, oh, this is absolutely terrible. Someone had left the front gate open and he used to hang around the garden with me and sleep on the front veranda.
And come in the house if you leave the door open.
Yes. Anyway, he's heading up towards the mares at the end of the road. And all I could think of was I had a bucket on the veranda and I grabbed some rocks and I threw them in the rocks and I called out to him. And he came galloping back up to me to leave the mares. And I thought, oh, he's got his priorities right.
Yes. Do people ever accuse you of loving these horses more than humans?
Oh, of course. And a lot of, especially men, would say to me, oh, you make a fool of that stallion. And I'd think, well, I'd rather him be nice and affectionate to me and me spoil him. But most of the time he was so tractable and such good company.
And a lot of old men I found, they would just turn up and say, can I have a look at your horse? Don't you? Of course, you know. And then they would just turn up regularly. Then they would start saying, they're the horses we had when I was young and they're the horses we had up the lakes and they're the horses we used to muster cattle on. You just don't see them anymore. And they just light and they'd just sit down because the horses would come up to them and go, oh, hello, how are you going? I mean, my horses now get a lot of little children visitors. So they just run down the paddock with carrots and the wailers come up, you know, oh, hi, you know, they can run in between their legs.
Mm. And how about you, Jenna? Do you sometimes accused of liking horses more than people?
Probably, but people say that about people's dogs too, don't they? I suppose it's that non-judgmental love, isn't it? Of course, that's your mate, you know.
It's been really lovely to speak to the both of you. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you.
It's
been our pleasure, Richard.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.